This isn't, oh, there was an unintended extubation in bed 26, I'm going to go reintubate. This is tube is out, cardiac arrest.
Welcome back to Pete's Grit. I'm Zach Hodges, a pediatric ICU fellow from UT Southwestern in Dallas.
And I'm Alice Shanklin, a critical care fellow at Children's National in Washington, D.C.
So Alice, who are we speaking with today?
Today we are talking to Dr. Greg Urosek about the Norwood. Dr. Urosek is one of our CICU attendings at Children's National Hospital. He's also the director of critical care simulation, and he draws the best single ventricle diagrams.
Yes. Part two is really a deep dive into what actually happens in the OR when you're having a patient who's been taking for a Norwood and how you optimize that patient after you get them back. We go through many of the nuts and bolts for what you deal with that first post-operative night and some clinical cases when things don't go well.
Yes, it really takes you to the bedside. Let's get to the episode. The kid is getting rolled down to the OR. What are they actually doing? What are the steps of the Norwood procedure?
The Norwood is kind of an all-day thing a lot of the time, and at least for me, I want it to be. And the reason is I like to send the babies down to the Norwood procedure not having begun much of their operative course. And by that, I mean they shouldn't be all lined up. They shouldn't have an IJ in and be intubated and this, that, and the other thing. These kids should ideally have umbilical lines and a peripheral IV, and that's about it. And so the first part of that, as you know, Alice, is going to be sort of intubating the child, typically nasally, and then getting some sort of central access, and then opening the chest, and it's obviously a virgin chest. So generally getting a Norwood on bypass is not uncommon, that even as a first case, that's not happening for a couple of hours into what we think of as the operation. So first and foremost, make sure you're speaking with our families. You're saying your child's probably going to be back late in the afternoon. I think an early afternoon return from a Norwood is great and we love it, but a late afternoon return is not uncommon. So what needs to be done? Well, we went through just a touch of this before in looking kind of at our three things. We need to establish our systemic outflow that's going to be unobstructed, consistent, and good. And why don't we start there? So we talked just a second about sort of this analogy, and I don't know if it's useful. It's helped me over the years, this idea of the highway and the on-ramp. And so you're going to need to sort of tack together this pulmonary artery and the native aorta to make a new aorta or a neo-aorta. Now, conceptually, that seems easy, but keep in mind that the native aorta is almost always less than 5 millimeters and sometimes 2 or 1. And so opening that vessel up and then basically making a circumferential new vessel is not easy. There's a name for that part of the procedure called the DKS, the Damus K. Stansel. It's named after three gentlemen some time ago who sort of described that procedure as it is. So I mention that just because you can sort of think of the creation of the neo-aorta, in my mind, as sort of three surgical things. The first is the one that I just said, the DKS. The second is, okay, so now you've used the pulmonary artery, right, as part of your neo-aorta, and you're going to use that pretty much up until the PA would have become the MPA. But then there's no other pulmonary artery left, right? And you've got this teeny tiny hypoplastic ascending aorta and transverse arch. You need to augment that. And that augmentation typically is done by filleting open the underside and augmenting that with some sort of patch material. Usually not homograft, but rather patch like Gore-Tex patch. And there's a lot of other things that our surgeons will use. And essentially what you're doing is you're creating the continuation of this new aorta beyond where the MPA would have stopped. That's sort of the second part, arch augmentation. The third part is, remember that a coarctation of the aorta is part and parcel of the hypoplastic left heart syndrome complex, right? And so you need to get rid of the ductus, get rid of the ductal tissue, and open that up and connect your now nicely developed transverse arch with graft material as well as the native aorta and connect that to the descending aorta. So it's a coarctectomy in addition. So you've got the DKS, you have the arch augmentation, and then you have the coarctectomy and reanastomosis. And so those are sort of the three surgical aspects to the Norwood procedure. And any surgeon will tell you that they're really difficult. They're all different. The tissue is small. They're trying to do a lot of things with very little there. The tons of suture lines, getting the right size graft material and coloring it just right to the MPA is difficult. Getting the distal arch to anastomose to the descending aorta without getting an extra fold in there or a setup for something we called recoarctation is really, really difficult. So that's kind of your first part of the Norwood procedure.
It seems that everything you described so far is focused on getting blood to the systemic perfusion. optimizing that. So making sure there's no obstruction, whether that's at the creation of the knee aorta or maybe at the coarctation it was before.
Exactly, Zach. And you have to use everything you got, right? Essentially, now you've got the PA bifurcation, right? And it's just sort of, at least conceptually, it is just kind of hanging out there, right? And you're thinking, I now have to do something to get blood to it from this thing that I just made. And it kind of, once you think of it that way, at least in my non-surgical mind, I think of it that way, it kind of makes sense. You got two options. You can stick something in the ventricle and have it pump in a systolic manner into the PAs. That's called a Sano shunt, named after a Japanese surgeon in the 90s. The other option is, I don't want to do that. I'm going to do a systemic depulmonary shunt from somewhere else in my aorta. I don't want to do it from this whole thing that I just reconstructed. There's a lot of suture lines. It's a big vessel. I'm going to do it from the innominate artery, which is just further up the neck, and I'm going to anastomose that via a shunt, this thing called the BTT shunt or Blaylock-Tassig-Thomas shunt, and that is going to anastomose the systemic vasculature to typically the right pulmonary artery. The difference is important, and it kind of makes sense when you think of it this way. In the first case, you're pumping blood out into the PAs, so there's only going to be a systolic output at that time. The exciting thing about this is you don't have as much of a runoff lesion. This is why the Sano was sort of advertised and used and is used all the time in many, many centers. And therefore, it's usually a bigger tube graft. Typically, 5 or 6 millimeters is a typical Sano size for like a 3 kilo kit. For that kid, you'd probably use a 5. The other way, if you do a BTT shunt, it's going to fill the PAs in systole and diastole, so there's going to be continuous runoff. It's similar to a ductus, and so you use a much smaller tube graft for that. Typically, 3.5 millimeters is sort of the almost universally sized systemic depulmonary shunt that would be used for that. So those are the two options of shunts that are going to get the blood from either the ventricle or the systemic architecture out to the PAs.
You know, when you start in the cardiac ICU as a PICU fellow, you walk around the unit and it's like bed 1, Norwood BTT shunt. Bed 2, Norwood Sano. Bed 3, Norwood BTT shunt. What's the difference here? Why do some kids get one and some kids get the other?
Yeah, so I mean, that's really a surgeon's decision. There's a few reasons for it. For kids where the dominant ventricle is the right ventricle, for example, with a hypoplastic left heart, the structure of the RV is such that it's a bit flat on the top, and therefore dunking a tube into it is very doable. When you have a dominant left ventricle, let's say you had like a unbalanced canal or some other structure where you didn't really just have a classic RV looking at you that the surgeons are trying to figure out how to do a systemic depulmonary shunt, that geometrically is sometimes not as advantageous and will not be chosen for the Sano approach. Although that's true, what I just said, honestly, the most common one is surgeons are often surgeons that do BTT shunts or Sanos. And typically, our surgeons don't go back and forth from one to the other. It's difficult. It's a hard thing to do. And you have to, no matter how good you are, you got to keep doing it over and over again to get better and better at it over the years. And so typically, you'll have your surgeons will do it just one way or just the other. I will pause to say we do have some evidence, because I would imagine that the first question that always came to my mind is, well, why do we do one versus the other? Is it really just the man or woman that's in the OR that's deciding what to do surgically? Well, we do have some information which is, pretty strongly suggests that there's some initial benefit from doing the Sano as far as even survival. Yes, there's a little bit of a survival advantage, some length of stay, time to extubation, things of that nature. But having a Sano often, at least statistically speaking, puts kids in at risk for more operations as an interstage than doing a BTT shunt. And when you watch these kids out to age 1, 2, and now we have 5-year data, that signal of survival seems to disappear before they're a year of age. So whatever that early survival benefit that might be there, and again, these numbers were close, but it was believed by the CICU community as well as the surgical community that Sanos do offer probably a short-term benefit in survival, it seems to evaporate by the time the kids are a year. And whether that's because of these additional procedures that seem to happen in the kids with the Sanos, or if it's just because once you get them out of that early area, maybe it's just a peri-op, post-op issue, once you get them to 4 to 6 months or whatever, they all seem to get in line with the survival of the other group.
Interesting.
And you're probably referring to the SVR single ventricle reconstruction trial, is that correct?
I certainly am, Zach. Thank you.
We'll be sure to leave a link to that in our show notes.
You definitely should. It's a very, very important, well-constructed trial that is still ongoing as we are getting more and more information on kids. So we have 1 year, 2 year, well, initial 6 month, then 1 year, 2 year, now 5 year data, and data is continuing to be followed. It's sort of our version of the Framingham Heart Study.
Wow, that's great. As this procedure is finishing up, what physiologic goals does the cardiac anesthesiologist have before the patient is liberated from bypass?
So an important thing that anesthesiologists will be wanting to do, obviously, is make sure all the access is where it ought to be, right? Mm-hmm. So typically, these kiddos will have some sort of a central line that gets placed as part of their procedure. That's frequently an IJ line. There's some centers that don't do that. They will have the surgeons just place common atrial lines, because remember, we didn't really do the third part, but as we went through before, like, the third part is going to be the atrial septectomy. And so when you say an RA versus an LA line and a Norwood, it doesn't really matter. It's a common atrial line. So they'll usually have like a double lumen common atrial line. They still have the umbilical venous line that they went down there with. Sometimes an IJ will be placed on top of that, basically to facilitate removal of the umbilical line. The endotracheal tube, which is typically a nasotracheal tube, and then maybe a peripheral IV. And then the last thing is going to be, you want to make sure that your arch is healthy. So you're going to want to almost always place a right radial arterial line. And then you'll be able to compare that to the umbilical arterial line, basically as a surrogate to say there is no arch obstruction, right? So at least from the part of takeoff of the first branch of the arch until the descending aorta, you'd be able to say, well, they both say 80, so I know we're good. Mm-hmm. And so those are the first thing, Alice, I'd say from an anesthesia standpoint, is to make sure the patient comes up with the exact access, and they're often a bit over accessorized, if you know what I mean, when they first come up, and then we sort of peel things off as they come. The second would be, can any fluid sort of be ultra filtered or muffed? And we won't go too much into that now, but basically there's a lot of blood products that are given as a part of an operation like this. These kids can be pretty coagulopathic. There's also a fair amount of surgical bleeding. A lot of things go into these kids. They get pretty puffy. If some of that fluid can be taken off via bypass before separating the child from bypass, that's what ultrafiltration is. Sometimes you kind of start from a point where they're not quite as swollen, they don't have as much edema, and you might be able to be a little more stable and not really run into like the giant swollen day two Norwood. That is not infrequently the case. The last thing I just mentioned is typically after a Norwood, I wouldn't say universally, but I would say in places I've worked, the child's often brought up open-chested. And the open chest is sort of for two things. So first, you're not bringing the sternum together, so the heart can sort of fill a little bit better. Ventricular dysfunction is not typically a huge issue as far as systolic ventricular dysfunction after a Norwood, but filling can be a bit of a problem, and allowing the ventricle to be able to fill easily can be helpful. It's easier to ventilate a child if the chest is open. And then probably one of the more important things is if the child were to have an event, the tourniquets are still in place and they could rapidly be put on ECMO through the chest. So for all three of those reasons, and it's hard to know which of those reasons matters more, which ones are more theoretical than real, these patients will typically come up with an open chest. So from an anesthetic standpoint, try to bring the kids back, maybe not as a little drier than they were mid-op. Make sure they're fully accessorized. We talked about a little about the open chest. And then obviously a really good bedside sign out. Have that really prepared when you arrive to the unit.
A common question that we'll ask in our post-op series is there anything really specific for this operation that you want to hear about in anesthesia and surgical sign out? I mean, of course, we want to know about bypass times and many other things, but anything specific for this lesion?
Although, Zach, this isn't specific to this lesion, the airway stuff is paramount. And that's just because if this child were to get in trouble with needing to be reintubated or unintended airway loss or can't be ventilated, need to put a different tube in, you need to know that stuff because no patient has as little reserve as a kid like this, right? This isn't like, oh, there was an unintended extubation in bed 26, I'm going to go reintubate. This is tube is out, cardiac arrest, right? Knowing that it was easy to put in, that the view was good, that the size tube was good, that they were easy to ventilate perioperatively will be really, really important. And then going back to the other parts of your question, specific to this. So obviously, is it a sono or is it a BTT shunt? If it's a sono, typically these kids are a little easier to manage for some of the reasons that we talked about immediately postoperatively. And that's just because the blood goes to the lungs just in systole. Their saturations are often not quite as high as the BTT shunt kids, their PO2s are a little bit lower, and if anything, they sometimes need a little bit of oxygen. For the BTT shunt kids, they typically have very high sats, fairly low blood pressures, fairly high pulse pressures, and they're kind of thumping and bounding on exam and present a unique and sometimes very difficult challenge postoperatively. It doesn't mean that the Sono kids are easy to manage, but in my experience, they're easier to manage. So you want to know what size shunt did they use. If it's a 3.5 kilo kid and they used a 4.0 Sono, this kid might get blue. And you might want to ask, well, why did you choose that? Usually we'd use like a 5 or a 6 with this kid. If it's a 3.2 kilo baby and they decide on a BTT shunt and it's a 3.0, worry about the shunt clotting, right? That's an issue. It's small. If it's a 4.0, worry about the child having heart failure and too much pulmonary blood flow, right? These are important things. So know what is typical so that you know what to ask for when it's atypical. And you could say, well, why were those decisions made? Obviously, bleeding, Zach, is going to be really, really important. So you got to figure out, is this, and anesthesiologist is just amazing at this. Just ask them, well, just sort of like on a scale of 1 to 10, like I know that you gave this many platelets and this much cryo and it's all good. Someone will write it all down. It'll be in the note, I promise. But what I want to know is, was this kid actively hemorrhaging as they were getting ready to put the ESMARC on, or were things nicely controlled? How much surgical bleeding is going on versus is the kid just coagulopathic because they're cold or because the operation took 7 hours? You know, those are the kind of, you know, the kind of things you want to sort out when they're there. And then last, how much support was required when they came off bypass? Did they come off the first time? When they did come off, did they come off on epi of 0.15 and norepi of 0.1? Or did they come off how we like to see in Norwood, with a pretty good blood pressure, a little bit of low-dose epi, maybe loaded with milrinone, no arrhythmias, a little more hemostasis, put the ESMARC on, bring the child up open-chested, and there we are.
All great stuff. I must ask, what's an ESMARC?
That's just the membrane that goes over the chest when you're open-chested. Yeah, so the open, of course, isn't open, like, you know, to the elements. It's just that the sternum isn't closed.
Nice. All right. So now it's post-op night one. What clinical strategies are you performing to optimize cardiac output, ensure oxygen delivery?
So that's like a million-dollar question, right? The first few hours for these kids, and it's been amazing watching people, you know, over the years that have been the people that trained me and picking up things from them. And I think one of the things that I've learned and one of the things I try to do with my own patients and I try to teach fellows to do this is think of the first few hours with a kid like this as establishing a reserve. You kind of have a getting to know you time and you want to establish the reserve that you can. There's a few different things that you'll need to do. So from straight up, of course, you're going to need good hemostasis. You got to manage bleeding and all that good stuff. And if you're having a lot of bleeding, these kids will get in trouble in a hurry. And if you're having a lot of bleeding at the time of pass off into the unit, the surgeons cannot leave. They're going to need to re-explore the kid, maybe go back on bypass. This is not something where you're just like, oh yeah, we had 10 per kilo per hour of chest tube output overnight, but the fresh Norwood was okay. No, that's not going to happen, right? So I want to just say that straight off the bat. So you need good hemostasis, you need good looking lungs, you need a good anesthetic course, and you need to be convinced that the child is off bypass and should be off bypass. And now you think, okay, what am I going to need to do? Well, this kid's probably going to have a good deal of capillary leak. They're probably going to need some volume tonight, and they're probably going to have some acute diastolic dysfunction. They may have a bit of a component of systolic dysfunction, and they may have maybe not the greatest vascular tone. So what I start with typically is a fluid replacement strategy a priori. And I do that just because I find that catch-up fluid replenishment doesn't happen as fast as we'd like it to. And so if we typically, for these kids, what we'll say is if they have chest tubes, and they will, they often will have a PD drain, a peritoneal drain. Of course, that's just a drain in the peritoneum. It's not for dialysis, and almost never do we need to use it for dialysis, but it just drains the peritoneum. Typically, we'll take those fluids, add them up every hour, and replace them, say, 1-to-1 with something like 5% albumin or saline. There is no evidence whatsoever that one is better than the other for this, and there's no evidence that a fluid replacement strategy is better than not doing one. But I'm just giving you my sort of approach to the post-op Norwood. I think fluids going in each hour, at least for the first 12 hours, and sort of replenishing what has been lost can be very, very helpful. So that's one thing. Once the crit gets below, say, 35 or even close to 35, I transition a little bit and give some blood over a couple of hours while those fluids are also going. So really, really good, robust preload is going to be one approach here. The next thing is your inotropic strategy. The good news is you understand the physiology really, really well. And so you know what you want to do. The question is the child going to be on board with what you're doing? The perfect Norwood to me is a kid that you can put on a little bit of milrinone. And remember that you're going to lower your systemic vascular resistance with milrinone, which could be very attractive for this child post-bypass. Remember that what we know about low cardiac output syndrome is that although the systemic output can be low, the systemic vascular resistance is often very high. And this is kind of one of the things that got milrinone on the map, like in the late 90s and stuff with like the Primacor trial and all that stuff. So you're going to want to lower systemic vascular resistance, but remember that lowering SVR is akin, not identical, but akin to lowering blood pressure. Lowering blood pressure lowers diastolic blood pressure. Lowering diastolic blood pressure lowers the distance and the difference between what the coronaries will provide as far as filling the heart muscle, right? So your diastolic blood pressure minus your mean airway pressure, if that's 25 minus 10, you're in trouble. If the diastolic blood pressure is 40 and the filling pressure is 8, there's a good chance you're not in trouble. So keep that number in mind when you're starting vasodilatory drugs like milrinone. But the perfect Norwood would be you start them on a little bit of milrinone. And I love keeping a little bit of epi on in the background as long as the child's not having terrible ectopy or the child is markedly tachycardic. So if they're under like 160 even, typically I will put them on like 0.03 to 0.05 of epi, 0.25 to 0.5 of milrinone. Again, this is my practice. I want to be very clear about that. A lot of people would do it this way, but many people would do it quite a bit differently or at least a little differently. And let those meds sort of sink in and try not to mess with them too much. And then if I'm finding myself hypotensive later on, I'll use a little bit of vasopressin or norepi as my sort of alpha. And the alpha will give me the extra blood pressure that I want without the tachycardia. So I typically will park them on some epi and milrinone because I found that to be a useful strategy. And then if I need more blood pressure, and I often do, I will use something titratable that is not epinephrine. Again, that's just my way of doing it. So that's the vasoactive approach. And then we talked about sort of the volume approach. I guess the last thing would be, well, what are you getting out? Is the child making any urine? Is the output pretty much just PD output? And the fact is that's a pretty dependent variable. You can't really choose that first night. Some of these kids will just tighten up really nicely and they'll start making urine by 4 a.m. And some of them will be swollen as all get out. You know, 9/10 of their output will be PD output. And they won't pee, they won't have good urine output until the next afternoon. It's okay, right? Keep the tank full, keep the vasoactives on. If there's good hemostasis and the function's good, they're probably going to be fine. You might just have to wait a little bit. And the last thing that I would say about fostering good urine output, something that we'll use a bit, is systemic steroids in those first couple of days. This also is not evidence-based, but we will often give hydrocortisone for the first, say, 24 hours, typically every 6 to 8 hours, to sort of help with that capillary leak. It does seem to help with their blood pressure. It does seem to help them respond better to the things like the epi and the norepi that we give them. And typically that'll give you that little bit of that reserve to get them through. I kind of have the child ask for the hydrocort. I don't just give it up front. It's not a great drug and it's got a million side effects. We all know what they are. But if you are beginning to add a lot of vasoactive support and you're seeing less of a response to that support, I would reach pretty quickly for hydrocortisone. So I think, Alice, that's a lot there, but that would be sort of my first 4 to 6 hours of approach to the post-op Norwood.
Yeah, I really, really appreciate that. You covered all of the major points. You think about optimizing oxygen delivery for these kids. Really like the focus on comparing your diastolic pressure to your filling pressure and keeping in mind that's going to drive your coronary perfusion. I would assume outside of the cardiovascular and respiratory stuff that you mentioned, you can keep them heavily sedated, neuromuscularly blocked. Are you one that you target a very normal pH, 7.40 PaCO2 of 40?
I do. And I do just because it's what I'm comfortable with. And I just go back to basic physiological principles that muscular contraction is typically best at normal or just under normal pH. And I don't typically underventilate these kids, which is something you might do, as we talked about before you go to the operating room if you really have to. But I pretty much shoot for sort of 7440 gases and then a PO2 of anything from, say, 35 to 43. Something like that. And that would depend on a sono versus a BTT shunt. A BTT shunt with a PO2 of 45 might be pretty sick. A sono with a PO2 of 45, a lot of these kids aren't in room air. You might just need to make a vent adjustment there.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Pete's Crit. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as a replacement for medical advice. It's also worth noting that the views expressed during this episode by me, Zach, and our guests are our own and do not reflect the official position of our institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at pedscritpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to help support the production of PedsCrit, you can find us on Venmo and Patreon. We've also had some light merch made in the form of PedsCrit laptop stickers. And if you include a mailing address with any contribution, we would be so excited to send you one. Thank you again for listening.